This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. This week on Rebranding Safety Podcast, she's back. Helen Heenan returns. Let's jump into the intro and I'll tell you some more about it.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Riskfluent. What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is the YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. We're here to change the perception of safety. We do that right here on the podcast, and we do that over on YouTube as well. So if you're new here, hit that subscribe button and the bell and all those magical algorithm buttons as well. So today we are talking to, again, we are talking to Helen Heenan, the amazing, the lovely Helen Heenan returns. It's like a really good version of Batman Returns, arguably one of the better Batman. But I don't want to get into that, even though I could do a separate podcast on the Batman films because I just love them. But anyway, before I get into our chat with Helen, just a quick word from our sponsors. Firstly, a little shout out from my own company, Project Miletium. Project Miletium is the mastermind community for safety professionals. Yesterday, as I record this on Sunday, yesterday we had our second ever quarterly wagon wheel. That's like a mastermind event that we run every quarter. We have a keynote, then we do workshops with that keynote speaker. And then we do something called a member's journey or a member's section. And this is where a member could come on. They present their story or the context to the challenge that they're going to ask for. And then they tell us a challenge, something that they want some support with. And yesterday we had an amazing one. Yesterday, one of our members came on and talked about mental health and imposter syndrome within his career as a safety professional. And I would be underselling it if I told you that the conversation we had was just the most powerful thing I've ever experienced in my life. It was just phenomenal. And I've never experienced anything like that within any community, let alone a community of safety professionals. It was phenomenal. It was just unbelievable. It was emotional. It was raw. It was honest. It was open. And it was such a psychologically safe environment that everyone started sharing their own personal stories, their own personal challenges and how they deal with it. And we all helped each other to improve our own mental health and deal with many things, but obviously imposter syndrome was one of the main things that we were talking about. So, well, that's it. I think, yeah, if you want to join, check it out, www.projectmedium.com. Or if you want to try one of our community calls out, which run weekly on a Wednesday and a Friday, then hit me up or hit Colin Nottage up or email me at projectmedium.com and we'll get you a free trial. You can try it out before you buy it. Honestly, I know it feels like, well, I'm going to pay for a LinkedIn group and some community call and some Zoom calls. That may be what it sounds like. There's loads of other stuff like courses and resources. But ultimately, those calls are phenomenal. And don't knock it till you try it. Trust me, it's just unbelievable. Now let's talk about our proper sponsor for Rebranding Safety YouTube channel and podcast, Paradigm Human Performance, but more specifically, their HSE subscription service. HSE subscription service is designed by human and organizational performance experts, which are Paradigm, but it's targeting that SME community, those businesses, those CEOs, those managing directors, those business owners that are just juggling all the balls, spinning all the plates, and probably at the same time, you are just so busy that sometimes safety, maybe you care about it and you care about your people. I think everybody does, but sometimes it's just, you think it's all right, but maybe you think I should check that out one day, or maybe I should ask for some help or some support in case I do kind of slip and start to drift away from reality, which is life. This is the package for you. Paradigm Human Performance will help you nail down all those regulatory, legal and industry compliance get that sorted, but also help you put worker safety at the DNA to help you appreciate the workers' subject matter expertise of the job, of the risk in the day-to-day reality. Something that even some of the most successful companies struggle to do. So this really is a tick all the boxes package. It's not like a compliance system that you're going to have to declutter in a few years when you realize that you need to evolve to manage the human factors side of things and become a bit more systemic and so on. Or systematic, not systemic. You know, you're not going to have to do that because it's already done. You're already dealing with HOP experts. I absolutely love what Paradigm are doing. They're all about just educating the world, working with some amazing clients and helping them be better. It aligns with everything I do. It aligns with rebranding safety. It aligns with me personally. It aligns with Project Millennium. It absolutely aligns with everything I do. And that's probably why Therese is involved in pretty much everything I do, because I just get her. She's just an amazing person and she's built an amazing team of people around her as well. So if you're still not sure, you're still not sold on it, you can go to their website and join the Learning Organization webinar as well. So you can get to meet the team, listen to their conversations, experience their subject matter expertise before you go and partner up with them. But if you listen to me, I think you should just partner up with them. If you need that support, if you're a small and medium-sized enterprise, you need that help, I really do think you should go and work with them. They're amazing people. Even if you're not an SME and it's not HSC subscription service and you're like, actually, I could just do with some human organizational performance help, check them out. Honestly, they are phenomenal. So thank you very much to Paradigm for sponsoring Rebranding Safety, and thank you for taking a moment to listen to those adverts. I appreciate it. It helps us keep the quality going and improving as we grow and as we learn, as we buy new equipment, as we finally kind of cover the cost of some of the stuff. And so thank you very much for listening to the advert and all the adverts prior. I appreciate it. We're doing as much as we can, working with our partners to make sure that we can diversify the adverts and make them interesting so that it's not just like listening to the same old thing all the time. So bear with us. We'll hopefully kind of make it sound a bit more interesting going forward. And I'll start to use my imagination of ways to do it. Podcast a little bit harder. YouTube, there's things we can do there, but podcast difficult. Anyway, without further ado, let's get into Helen Heenan then. I'm not going to talk about too much because you know Helen because you would have heard her in part one. But in summary, in part one, we spent a lot of time, probably about half the podcast, talking about Helen's really complex kind of challenges within the industry. And we talked about how it kind of ended for Flybe during COVID and what that meant for Helen. We also talked about being a woman in aviation and her kind of unique perception or opinion on it, which I thought was interesting. We delve a little bit into that in the reflection. And we've also got a mini series coming up in the podcast imminently within the next few weeks, all focusing on diversity within our profession. So loads and loads and loads of episodes talking about diversity. But more to come on that later on. Today we get really into the depths of learning from human factors and CRM training and how Helen runs her training sessions. So if you're doing training, you're a trainer, you know, trust me, this is for you. This is the podcast. This is, if you only ever listen to one podcast again and you're a trainer, you're a facilitator, or you're a coach or anything like that, you're running workshops, even meetings, if I'm honest, even like safety committee meetings, you want to make them a bit more engaging, this 100% is the podcast you should listen to. It blew my mind. And we touched on that in the last podcast, and that's why we brought it back, because we needed to do a more in-depth version of this. So Helen Heenan is back. She returns for another episode on Rebranding Safety, talking all about training. Let's get into the conversation. All right, Helen, welcome back to the podcast.
Hello. Well, it's lovely to be back, actually, and quite exciting to be back, actually. Very flattered to be asked back.
Well, I think last time we just kind of, we covered so much, but we spoke a lot about your career and your challenges through COVID as well, which I think is really important and it's really interesting. So I didn't want to like cut that. And also neither of us could spend another 2 hours talking. And I thought, and as we got to the last like 30 minutes, you started to just plow out all of this value that I was like,
why are we not talking about this? And then I was like, oh, we don't have enough time. So I was like, we desperately need to come back on and chat again. So we're going to pretty much kick off where we took off the last time. But in case anyone hasn't listened to the other one, you just want to give yourself a little introduction and then we'll crack on.
Yes, of course. So my name is Helen Heenan. Up until the 5th of March last year, I was a Q400 captain with the regional airline Flybe. And then when the airline went into administration, I, along with 2,500 colleagues, sadly got made redundant overnight. So since then, I've kind of specialised really more in doing what was another part of my job, as well as doing the flying side of things. I was also really passionate about training the human factors. And for 4 years, I was the head of the human factors training department for the aircrew, which involved, a lot of the writing of course materials, a lot of research into, sort of new methodologies, new ways of thinking, new concepts, new models, and then looking to apply that within the operational environment to then write and deliver, effective and relevant training programs for the aircrew. So I'm quite fortunate that that's actually quite a transferable skill, because a lot of the things that we taught were not aviation specific. They focus a lot on human factors and, human work. Mm. We applied it, of course, within our aviation environment, but of course they are cross industry. You can apply them in many areas. So since then, I now sit on the Human Factors Advisory Panel to the CAA, and I'm also a training course director with Cura Human Factors as well, looking at delivering the Train the Trainer courses. So we don't necessarily teach the materials. We don't teach the courses, although that is something that we can do, but the area that we focused on and what I was taken on for is actually the training of the trainers. Mm. So we teach people how to teach it. Rather than teach them the stuff, we teach them how to teach the stuff and how to teach it effectively as well within their particular organisations.
Yeah.
And I started a degree as well.
Oh, have you? So you didn't have much to do before.
No, well, I had a bit of a midlife crisis, obviously after losing my job. Rather than buying like a speedboat or a motorbike or, a Porsche, I decided to invest my redundancy money into doing a degree. So I am currently probably about a third of the way through a master's degree, an MSc, through Coventry, which is in human factors in aviation, which I love it. I'm absolutely loving it. I
looked at that one, actually. I've never worked in aviation. I have no intent to go into aviation, but I really want to do an MSc in human factors. There are a couple more now since I last looked. I know, because I raised this in a WhatsApp group that I'm in, and a few guys were pointing me in another direction. But last time I looked, the human factors was really just focused in like high hazard industries and aviation. You couldn't really get it for normal work, if I kind of say that in quotations. Like, there wasn't a human factors for just work, just like or human factors and health and safety or something like that, which is kind of frustrating, because for me it was kind of like, well, actually, it's so much of what I do is human factors. Yeah. And I'm like, so why is it just this specialist thing, which was interesting. So yeah, but now they're starting to come out. They're starting to see, you're really starting to see this human factors kind of really start to kind of pregnate the safety education. Like I know there's the MSc, I think it's for University of Birmingham, but I could be wrong. The MSc for health and safety, like I say, it could be a different uni, but I think it's Birmingham. they've now got a human factors module, which is interesting. It's really nice to see human factors starting to enter the traditional routes of education for safety professionals. So
that's interesting.
How far into your MSc are you?
Well, it's a 2-year course, because I'm doing it as a part-time distance learning degree. That's how it's marketed. And so I am now onto module 4. So we do 2 modules each semester. So we're in the second half of the second semester, if that makes sense. So we've got 2 more modules after this to the summer. Then next year, we have another 2 modules in the autumn term. And then the next 2 terms is spent doing our research project, and actually we're doing a thesis on on whatever it is that we want to research around human factors in aviation. And I've got a list as long as my arm of things that I'm sort of toying with looking at, actually. But, you know, I think I need to be realistic about, you know, what's achievable in that time frame, because it's not just about, you know, getting the answers and having the ideas, but when you actually put together, well, how would I actually research that? You know, how would I actually gather data? Who would I ask? How would I have access? Mm. And particularly at the moment with, you know, with the pandemic restrictions and access to, you know, unlimited access to, you know, simulators, training organizations is just not available at the moment. So, you know, have to sort of think very carefully about not just what I want to do, but actually what's achievable as well. So kind of working with a few ideas. I keep jotting down little notes on my phone. I've got that little notes app where you can just like write ideas down. So as soon as something pings into Helenland, that's it. It goes down that little list thing. Oh, that might be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I really want to get into this training and stuff, and I actually think it'd be really good to just talk about the trainer stuff, like I think that would be really interesting. But when I want to see what you think. This is an example I kind of use when I talk a little bit about. Excuse me, I haven't put my phone on silent. Apparently, that's embarrassing, isn't it? My own podcast and being my phone's seeing up bloody Pinterest as well. I thought I turned all my notifications off. Let me turn this on silent.
I don't understand Pinterest. I don't understand it at all.
Well, it's just lots of pretty images, really.
Well, yeah.
I use it for inspiration for a lot of stuff, really. If I'm looking for something, I don't know, how to design my office or design thumbnails for a podcast or something like that,
go on
Pinterest. Yeah. My wife uses it we're kind of in a very long, drawn-out process of renovating our house, so she uses it quite a lot for that, like living room ideas and things like that. It's good for that.
Fair enough.
Anyway, what was I saying? Yeah, when I kind of, when people go, well, what is human factors? And I give this example sometimes. I've done it once or twice, and sometimes I think, is this a good example? But then I think, yeah, it's a good example. It's the film Sully.
Okay.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Where the geezer lands the plane on. And in the
just so we're clear, he did crash it. That was officially a crash.
Sorry, yeah, not lands. No one lands on a river.
It was just a very good crash.
he controlled crash. Yeah. Yes. Okay. I'm very aware. I'm talking to a pilot now. I feel a bit nervous okay. about this. But like when he's in the kind of court process, the investigation process, loads of people there. And like, they say like this, what made me, you mentioned simulations, which is what reminded me of it. And they go through and they're like, well, this person did the simulation and they, you know, basically they're using all these simulations to say that what Sully did was wrong. And then what he does is challenge it back all the time. He'd be like, well, yeah, but you need to reenact the actual situation. And he kind of keeps going through this process and he finds it. And I feel like what he's doing is getting them to realize the human factors side of this, the emotion that was running through, the context of the situation, the pressure and all these little bits and bobs, you know, and it just was so interesting to watch. Not just because it's a great film, but that scene where they throw in everything at him and he's just like, for me, it feels like what he's doing is recreating that situation to say, well, that simulation is not what I was going through at the time and what my team was going through at the time. And for me, that's human factors kind of in a nutshell. You're trying to understand what that human goes through at the time and how they're thinking and what influences their behaviors and so on.
The line that the killer line that you refer to there is just when he says you're not considering the human factor.
Yeah. And that, does he actually say that in the film?
Yeah, he does. He actually says it in the film. They're throwing everything at him. They're sort of saying, oh yeah, but you know, these people managed it and these people did it, and you didn't do this, you didn't do that. And he just looks at them in the eye and he says, but you haven't taken into account the human factor.
I didn't even pick that up when
and
I watched
it. And then there's this silence. And then they say, well, what do you mean? And then he goes into the fact that, but these people went into this simulator premeditated, pre-primed. Yeah. They knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
They knew when it was going to happen. And they'd been instructed on, you know, what to do about it straight away. Yeah. So there was no decision-making had to be done. That had been done for them. And like you say, you know, all of a sudden, bam, you've got no engines. Literally no pilot in the world has ever been trained to deal with that scenario. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you know, he's sort of, he'll be rattling through every single possible outcome in his head at lightning speed. I mean, we've got a pretty powerful computer up here, to be honest with you, running through every single permutation, you know, at quite literally lightning speed, realizing that actually the only option they've got is to do what they did. Mm. And it, you know, it's fascinating, really. Even going back to, you know, when I learned to fly and single engine aircraft, one of the things we have to evidence is what they call an EFATO, which always used to be very hilarious because it said the word fart, but actually it was EFATO, engine failure after takeoff. And with a single engine aircraft, of course, that could have some negative consequences because you can't keep going. So the examiner, and well, the instructors first, obviously, but then the examiner simulates an engine failure after takeoff where they just bring the throttle back and you basically have to say, right, okay, I'm going to land over there. And one of the things that is drummed into you from the very first time you discuss this concept is that you never turn back. You do not turn back to your airfield because you won't make it, frankly. Yeah. You haven't got the speed, you haven't got the height. The amount of speed, the amount of lift you lose in a turn is not enough to turn around and go back. Yeah. So, you know, the fact that they were even suggesting, well, why didn't you try and return back to the field? Like, I'm not being funny, but, you know, 17-year-olds learn not to do that. Yeah. You know? I know what you say, that human factor, that decision-making process. And what's also quite interesting, what came out of that for me as a, you know, as a human factors nerd, I'm more than happy to call myself a nerd on this, is the realization, and we talk a little bit about this in our training as well, is that actually, do you know what, every single day you go to work, you are experiencing situations for which you have not specifically been trained. Every single day.
And you think, because every day, really? Is different in a way, isn't it? Yeah,
absolutely. Now you go to the simulator, which is, I call the simulator the laboratory, really. If you look at it from a scientific perspective, when people are doing tests and they're looking at controls, it's a very controlled environment. So a simulator has to be considered like a laboratory. Yeah. And it does its best to reenact, you know, reality and the answers you can get from that. Mm-hmm. But it is a lab environment, you know, it is very, very controlled and you can do what you want in there.
Yeah.
So what I found, what's quite interesting, is that they train you in the sort of the general procedures. But actually, do you know what, as pilots, every single day, you know, you say, okay, well, what was the last instrument approach you flew? Oh, well, I flew, you know, into Manchester yesterday. Oh, okay, right. And have you been trained to fly that approach? And you can see them thinking, obviously. Yeah. But actually, have you been trained to fly that approach on that day, in that weather, with that air traffic controller, with that co-pilot, at that weight, with that traffic around, you know, with that configuration, with that speed control? Well, of course you haven't.
The list could go on as well, couldn't it? Like, your psychological state on that day, your co-pilot's, like, literally, could that list could just go on forever.
Yeah. Oh, it does. It's indefinite. And that happens almost every single minute of every single day that you are in an airliner. Is that it will never be the same as the day before or the day after. And some of the scenario, yes, okay, we practice our normal and abnormal scenarios in the simulator, but in terms of, you know, what the scientists and the specialists call is ecological validity, you know, how accurately does it really reflect the real world? Then actually you've got to consider it as a laboratory, and you have to acknowledge that, you know what, in the real world there are so many other factors. It is a massively complex, dynamic environment that no two scenarios will ever be the same. And, you know, for Sully, you know, to suddenly be put in that situation that he'd never experienced before, had never been discussed before, you know, he probably sifted through, you know, digging into his experience, digging into his long-term memory of, you know, he could have run through maybe 15 or 20 possible scenarios, you know, like that. Yeah. And then realize that it's not going to work. Oh, that might work. Let's try that. So we have, you know, they have this situation when we teach decision making, there's and it's one of my personal bugbears, there's often an emphasis to, you know, we teach decision making so that people make the best decision or the good decision. Right. You think, well, how do you define a good decision? You're right.
Yeah, carry on. I'm still playing with my camera. It's annoying me. Go on, sorry. That was rude of me. Carry on.
That's okay. You know, there's a lot of emphasis on decision making about making, you know, the best decision. And sometimes you have to accept that you just got to do what you can. And actually, sometimes, you know, there's part of our naturalistic decision making process is called satisficing. So it's good enough. You know, I do not have the capacity to run through any more scenarios. We're running out of time. This is going to have to be good enough. And then you run with it. And then if something significantly changes, that means it's not going to work, then yes, review your decision. But sometimes you just don't have time to do what is the optimum decision, the best decision. You've just got to do what you can and make the decision with the information. And that's a very, very common thing, actually. Particularly the more experienced pilots are, then the more options they've got that they know will be good enough. You know, yeah, that will work, right? And it's a workload management thing, effectively. You know, why would you sit there deliberately and artificially increasing your workload by thinking of maybe a few other options just for the sake of it, when actually you're thinking, right, that'll do. Let's make that decision. That one's done. Okay, let's concentrate on the next thing. Which, you know, in Sully's case was they then started to get some power back on the aircraft by, you know, starting the APU, the little auxiliary power unit. Then they were discussing, you know, how they were going to, you know, where they were actually going to aim for, who they had to tell, what they were going to do. But, you know, in terms of decision making, one of my other favourite lines from that film was, I think they'd just gone either over, I can't remember, they went past the bridge or over the bridge, I can't remember. But, I mean, fundamentally, they were, you know, at about 300 feet above the Hudson. You know, there were no more options at this point. And I love the way Sully just looked across at his first officer and said, you got any other ideas? You know, is there anything else we could do? And he was like, no, I think I'm out. You know, just so calmly, like what? What other options do you have at this moment? So it did really make me laugh. It's like, anything else you think, anything else you can think of? No, I'm out.
It is such a good film, but like listening to you talk about it now, like I'm desperate to watch it again. Like I'm kind of gutted the Six Nations is on because like I've got to watch that because I really want to watch this again. Oh, you must have been watching like that film, just geeking out the whole time. I can imagine you watching that. It's kind of like me watching just a new Star Wars film or something, like just full on geeking out.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, What I liked about the film is that it was very accurately represented in terms of its technical side of things. Okay. You know, often, you know, the minute you've got any kind of aeroplanes involved in a film, you know, you can pick out all the the lack of continuity.
All the bullshit.
You know, you know, and I don't know, my husband and I were watching a film the other day of some description, and they said, you know, it said, oh, there's such and such as, you know, flying in from Peru, and then this 737 like flies past the window. Like, not on that, but not. Seriously, that's not going to pick it from Peru.
You must be like me when I watch a film, because I've spent so long working in fire safety. If there's ever a fire in a film, like, I just wind everybody up. Like, but I can't stop myself. I cannot
well, that
stop
wouldn't
myself.
Work. Yeah, why I'm would like, you do that? Well, that wouldn't work. I wouldn't do that. Well, that wouldn't look like that at that point. No, well, wouldn't use that extinguisher, not on that type of fire.
He wouldn't even be able to see what he's doing in there. I don't even know why he would go in. Like, why would you even go in there? This fire's been on for like 30 minutes. The place would be black with smoke. And this guy, you got Dwayne Johnson's running around saving everyone. He'd be dead. I'm like, should be dead. He'd be dead. Like, and it's not the fire that kills you, it's the smoke, you know? Like, I'm a proper geek when it comes to that. Mm. Yeah. Well, actually, it should have been fine in there for at least 60 minutes if they've built that to compartmentation. So, you know, you could put her in there, call the fire service, everything would have been fine. End of film, and then it's factually correct. I'd imagine you as a pilot watching anything with a, like watching snakes on a plane, you're just like, well, that wouldn't happen. Well, that wouldn't happen. Not that we ever would have a load of snakes on a plane, but you know, anyway.
Anyway. You know, my husband and I are both such nerds that you can even tell what aircraft it is sometimes from like the undercarriage assemblies.
No way. Love
that's not
that.
A euphemism, by the way. That is genuinely. You know, just so we're clear. But, you know, you'll have a, I don't know, like an Airbus will fly past, you know, showing this plane, and then they'll sort of like have a close up of it coming into land. You think, well, that's a jumbo jet. You know, when did an Airbus A321 suddenly get, you know, quad bogeys underneath? You just think, surely, surely somebody could have done the continuity check on this. You know, it's not rocket science, you know. But anyway,
somebody I'm sure that's a plane. That's a plane. Looks like a plane. Done. Like most normal people.
Well, I'm sure that any professional, as soon as they, you know, watch anything on television that's, you know, other than the news, obviously, but, you know, in terms of films, documentaries, soaps that that goes around their profession, I bet it must just drive them potty. But going back to, you know, old Sully, I think the what was interesting was the whole investigation side of it. Yeah. And the bit that I wasn't all that clear from the film, because it was very much looking to, like, criticize him and, like, tell him that he did something wrong.
Yeah.
And what isn't clear is whether that culture was from the airline wanting to not take responsibility and be able to blame somebody to, you know, get an insurance play. I really don't know. Mm. Or because the film implied that it was very much led by the NTSB, the National Transport Safety Board, yeah. Which is the same as the AIB over here in the UK. And that's the bit that I find that I struggle with a little bit, actually, because, you know, when we talk about a just culture, when we talk about safety too, when we talk about safety differently, mm. you think, like, the guy got put in a situation and he did what he thought was best mm-hmm. at the time. Mm-hmm. What more is there to say?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, how on earth can somebody try and say, well, you shouldn't have done this, you shouldn't have done that? I'm being funny, yeah. sweetheart, but, you know, okay, you can't use the plane again. We'll take that as read, fine, you know. Mm. But everybody survived. Yeah. Everybody lived, yeah. you know. And I think that's the bit that I struggle with, was the culture mm. side of it. And it's not clear from the film. And if I'm honest with you, I haven't really sort of delved into the nitty-gritty of the investigation reports, to tell you the truth, but whether that, and I'm going to call it the blame culture, you know, that culpability was from the airline or whether it came from the government, from the NTSB, yeah. because, and regardless of who it came from, I was pretty disappointed in that, to be honest with you, in this day and age. I mean, what was that, 2010 that it happened? 11 years ago, 12 years ago? I can't remember. Yeah. But, you know, in this day and age, you know, to not recognise that somebody was placed in this horrific situation, did the best they could with the information available to them at the time, and actually ended up saving everybody, then what questions are there to answer? Yeah. But, you know, we're done.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, I'm going to watch the film again now. Right. No, it's cool. I feel like I want to watch the film with, like, you kind of just pausing it. Like, you should do like a reaction of Sully, like, watch it, record yourself watching it, pause it and be like, well, at this point, what's interesting here is that, like, I would love that. I would totally watch that. I'd pay to watch that. There you go.
There's it a date.
There you go. There's a new business there for you. I can see it now. Domino's Pizza, Sully, and you just pausing it. I could build up a crowd of people. I know Adam Johns will be listening to this podcast. I reckon he'd come along to that. He'd quite like that. I'm not sure if he's a pizza man, but he definitely.
We can do chips as well. You know,
chips.
Chinese curry, beer.
Just do it all. We're gonna please everybody here. Yeah. Right. Anyway, I feel like this in a proper. I feel like this could actually make some real good money here. Anyway, I feel this is a ticketed event. And there'll be 50% profits from myself and Helen, okay?
Oh, dear. That would be funny.
Yeah, it'd be great, I reckon. Right, anyway, we digress.
Anyway.
I'm really fascinated, actually, about this trainer work that you're doing, because, you know, I've been a trainer for so long, and I genuinely kind of thought I was pretty good at it until I spoke to you and realised I'm pretty crap at it. No, I'm joking. Like, there was so much that you said that blew my mind, like I just thought it was so good, and I was so gutted that we only had like half an hour left, and we were way over anyway. I think it's like a 2-hour episode anyway, and I was like, oh, I could talk about this forever. But, like, let's kind of start with this trainer course. Like, what are the kind of I don't know, can you break down, like, the key segments that you're trying to achieve from that trainer session? What are the kind of main key things that you need to that you need that trainer to have or develop or work on? Would that it's, and this is your trainer, that's for CRM training, isn't it? Or is it for human factors in general?
Well, at the moment, the course that we run with Kura is a CRM trainer course. So it's right. training people to become CRM trainers.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess arguably there's no reason why the same course structure couldn't then be, you know, put across other industries and just change the actual technical subjects to the relevant industry. I suppose it's something I've not really thought about that. One step at a time. what sort of things do we cover? I tell you what, they're all stuck on my fridge at the moment with a load of post-it notes, if I'm honest with you. I kind of do my course structure with post-it notes stuck on my fridge and sort of work out what would go well where and how would this follow on to that and how would this follow on to that and where do we need to put something else. But the entire course, it's a five-day course and it's multifactorial. So we need to teach kind of like the fundamentals of teaching and learning. We also need to have a look at the actual syllabus materials because being aviation, they love their regulations. I mean, there's literally books of this stuff. So we kind of teach them a little bit more about the regulatory side of it, because most often the people that are coming on the course, they have done CRM training as a class participant, if I use the word student, but, you know, as a crew member. But actually, when you then go to the training side of it, it's not only about standing in front of people and, you know, teaching them, you know, how to make better decisions, but it's actually making sure that what you're teaching is in line with regulatory requirements as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a syllabus that is prescribed for the recurrent training, which is what everybody has to do every year. You have to make sure that you cover the entire syllabus over a 3-year period.
Of course,
and then so how you break up the topics is entirely up to the organizer. The organization, the operator. So each airline will have published in their training manual that, you know, on cycle one, we're going to do these topics, and on cycle two, we're going to do these topics, and on cycle three, that we have to do these topics. So that's the first thing, is we teach them quite a lot about the regulatory side of it. And then, of course, you've got the different types of CRM training as well. So it's not just a case of talking about general human factors. The different courses that we teach, you have pilot and cabin crew courses can be split or they can be combined. You have initials, so what we call initial operator. So when people are joining an airline for the very first time, they have, as pilots, they have to do a 2-day initial operators course. As cabin crew, they do a 1-day course. You then do recurrent training, which, as I said, is just refresher training once a year that we cover the syllabus every 3 years. But of course, every single time, you know, year cycle one comes along, things have changed, you know, things have moved on. And this is where the difference is, I think, within human factors training from, say, technical training, because I flew the Dash 8 for just over 20 years. OK, and when I did my technical ground school 20 years ago, we learnt, for example, I don't know, how the prop reduction gearbox worked and what it did and all that kind of thing. 20 years later, it still does the same. It hasn't actually changed. We haven't got a new one. It doesn't do different things. Doesn't work in a different way. The standby hydraulic pump for the number one hydraulic system still works the same as it did 20 years ago. So it doesn't evolve. There may be a few elements of additional sort of like avionics that may get put on, but, you know, just like you have a new piece of software for your computer. But, you know, the fundamental basics of, you know, how does this aeroplane actually work is the same in 2002 as it is in 2021. Whereas with human factors, because a lot of it is about, you know, new research, new understanding, everything evolves. So every single time, so every 3 years when module cycle one comes along, you can't just regurgitate what you did 3 years ago and present it in a slightly different way, because it might not be right anymore. You know, there might be new thinking, there might be a change of mindset. And, you know, if we look at this whole concept of safety culture, you look how that's changed. It's been through 2 or 3 generations of safety culture over the last, say, 12 years. The same with if we look at error management and understanding, you know, threats and errors. We've been through 4 generations of threat and error management in the last 10 years. You know, it keeps changing. The philosophies keep changing. You know, we identify that humans make errors. Right. Well, I'll tell you what we'll do is we'll teach them why people make mistakes. And then if people know why they might make a mistake, maybe they won't make a mistake anymore. Yeah. And then, of course, that didn't work. So we thought, maybe we'll have to try something else now. So then we then went to, okay, well, let's talk about mitigations, and let's talk about threat management, and, you know, predicting what threats there might be, and, you know, what to do if we make an error. And that then fed into the safety culture, and that then fed into the reporting system and the just culture, etc. And now we've moved on again, you know. And actually, do you know what? We're now looking at this concept that at the point you recognize that you've made a mistake or something's not going quite to plan, do you know what? Who cares how it happened? Nobody cares at this point. What we focus on is now fixing it. So what competencies do we need to fix it? If we've made an error, an error of judgment, or we've just done something incorrectly, or if, you know, air traffic control have screwed us over and we, you know, we end up too high, too fast, do you know what? Nobody cares how it happened. Nobody cares why it happened. We have to fix it. So we're putting a lot of focus on now about looking at trends, where we've identified key training areas as a result of trend analysis, but more putting more emphasis on the management of threats and errors, as opposed to the identification of threats and errors. So that's just an example of, you know, a couple of areas that, you know, the whole philosophy of training changes. So that's something that's actually, it makes it interesting, but also it makes it sometimes quite daunting, because you kind of need to have this insatiable desire to want to research and want to learn and actually want to apply it. So that's another area that we look at. But the main area that we focus on from a train the trainer is that being a CRM trainer is not about being an instructor. So being an instructor and being a trainer in this particular environment is very, very different. We're not there to give people answers, and we're not there to tell them what to do. What we're there to do is to generate thinking, understanding about themselves, because, you know, a lot of the human factors, when we talk about, you know, personality awareness, when we talk about human performance and limitations, it's not a finite science. Everybody is different. Everybody responds in a different way. Everyone's got their default personality. Everybody's got their own set of learned behaviors based on their culture, based on their upbringing. Everybody has got their own preferred leadership style, for example. Everybody's got their own approach to decision making, different experience levels. You know, everybody's got different amounts of cognitive capacity. So workload varies, you know, depending on, you know, for a given task, workload varies. So therefore, workload management strategies vary very much in between each individual, but, you know, when you combine them, between the crew as well. So it's not a case of, right, do this, 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 and this, and it'll work, like you would, for example, with the technical side of things. But it's very much sort of like training principles and concepts and theories, then applying them, and then giving, you know, a few guidance to the class of, you know, how this applies to you, and some ideas of perhaps, you know, how you come across to other people, understanding that, how your approach might be misunderstood with other people, or, you know, why that approach isn't necessarily right for this. But also we focus a lot on, you know, what do we do well? What is your key strengths? Because, you know what, everyone's got their own strong areas. Let's focus on that. Let's take the safety two approach. Let's focus more on what people do well, rather than, you know, too much emphasis on maybe their suboptimal competencies, shall we say? Am I allowed to say that?
So whatever you want on here. Yeah, I think it's interesting, because what you came on to what I was actually going to say next, I was thinking of listening, and I was just like, actually, this is really interesting, because if you're training a trainer, which is kind of what you came on to, you're training a trainer in this kind of, you know, the just to focus on the kind of human factors side of that training, you kind of have to teach them human factors in from two different perspectives, like the human factors of what they're actually training, like how to deliver CRM training. So therefore the human factors of the pilot, the crew, and so on and so forth, and the CRM module of human factors, but also the human factors of them and the people they're training in that room at that time, which is what you kind of came on to. And I would probably really want to focus on that second bit. Like, that is fascinating. And I think that could really benefit so many people that are listening to this, like in safety, because we are kind of static in the way we train, especially in safety. I think we're so static. You know, PowerPoint presentation, and some people were like, "I don't do PowerPoint.
Don't mention it."
And you know what? I've done PowerPoints, and sometimes I have used PowerPoints, and there is a way and a time to use them. But I'm not going to get into a whole conversation about PowerPoints.
Don't get me started. Trust me, that's another whole episode. But no, I do agree. PowerPoint has a place.
Yeah.
I use it for images and for videos. Actually, it's very good at hosting videos because you don't have to worry about formats and links and programs and stuff. And it's very useful for embedding photographs as well. So it handles those very well. But other than that, we're done. No more. Please.
Yeah. And that is what you kind of said there is kind of where I was coming to. The point that you said earlier in a difference between an instructor and your kind of CRM trainer, to me sounded like I used to kind of call this, right, what are we trying to achieve here? Are we trying to train someone on a technical thing that they come away with? Are we instructing them, or are we trying to facilitate a conversation to come up together with an outcome? Like, what are we trying to do here? And sometimes you need to be an instructor type kind of trainer, and that's fine and it works, whatever. It's not personally my style, but whatever. And it works. And sometimes I will do that. Like, it could be, so for example, the last bit of training I ever delivered was fire safety. And we delivered that as a partnership between myself and the gentleman from the fire service, who was essentially an engineer. And he took a very instructor type stance. He did also tell some stories from his career, which were very enlightening and very, very interesting. But it was very much like, this is the regulation, this is what you must do, you know, do you understand? And that worked. And then I kind of just kind of, one, made it a bit more funny, because that's just what I do. I like to make jokes and make things funny. But also kind of try and understand the human side of this as well. Like, and understand that, you know, people ain't now as strange as folk, as my grandma used to say, you know, and understand that. So, and that applies in the training room as well, doesn't it? Like, you have no idea what delegates you're going to get on that day. And how do I create a room that facilitates all of those delegates that I just potentially have no idea who they are and what their personality traits are like, and what makes them comfortable, what makes them uncomfortable, what, Jesus, the list could go on. How do you explore that with your kind of delegates that are training to be trainers?
Well, first of all, very much lead by example. So, you know, it's not a case of do as I say, not as I do. It is very much, you know, we practice what we preach. And then what I tend to do is that I'll deliver, you know, some kind of, I don't know, module, some kind of part of the course, as if it was, you know, an instructional style of, okay, well, now we're going to cover this. Let's have a look at these topics here. And then what I do is I pick it apart in terms of, okay, what did we just happen there? Let's talk about how I delivered that. Because it is very much practicing what you preach. Now, one of the skills, I think, of being a good facilitator is not to do facilitation for the sake of it. Now, there's what really pains me, and I'll say the word pain, you know, I just sit there and sort of like tear my hair out, is when you have somebody who I don't know, they're asking for people's ideas on, you know, okay, what are the classic, give me some symptoms of fatigue, for example. And so they'll ask the class to give their answers, and so they'll ask the class their answer. They won't write anything down. They'll just say, oh, yeah, that's it. Somebody will suggest something and they'll go, no, not really. And you think, oh, come on. You've asked them for some symptoms of fatigue. You're asking them for their opinion. You haven't asked them for the right answer. And the difficulty is that as soon as you say no to somebody, that's it, bam. You'll get nothing out of them at all, because they don't want to, they'll feel humiliated in front of their peers, because they were confident enough to say something and you've just crushed them. So you haven't actually given them, you haven't validated what they're saying. So one of the things that and then the next bit of that is that they say, okay, let's have a look and see if we got those all. And they'll bring up a slide that's like got all the things that they wanted to make sure that you said. And you just think to yourself, well, what was the point of asking us if you're just going to use yours anyway. Yeah. Because actually the point of a skilled facilitator is that, okay, you might be looking to ask for symptoms of fatigue because it's leading on to, okay, how would you identify it between yourself? You know, how would you identify it in somebody else? Look at signs and symptoms, you know, split the two perhaps. But you've got to have the confidence and the depth of knowledge to work with whatever that class give you. So there is no right answer. You need to apply your knowledge and understanding to the examples that you're given.
This is so
and even if somebody and even if somebody gives you the completely the wrong answer, then the minute you say, oh, that's not really what I'm looking for, you're not going to get anything out of them for the rest of the session, frankly. So and so we actively encourage people that if you're going to do an open facilitative session, don't do it for the sake of it. If you need to instruct something, if you need to do a knowledge transfer, just tell them the information. Don't do this kind of like, oh, well, let's have a think at what your ideas are, because it's just time wasting, frankly. And it invalidates anything they're going to say anyway, if you're just going to overrule it with what you want to talk about. So what we then suggest is that symptoms of fatigue. You know, how do you feel personally? How do you feel when you're really, really tired? You know, what does it feel like for you? Mm. And then whatever anybody says, you must write that down. On a flip chart, on a whiteboard, whatever. You write down everything they say. You don't paraphrase, okay? If they come out with something and you think, well, shall I write this? Think, no, well, now you're taking ownership of what they've said. This is their idea, not yours. Yeah. You're asking them. And then, I mean, you'll get situations where somebody will give you some like massively long sentence. Oh, well, sometimes I feel a little bit like that. Do you know what I mean? And you think, well, I can't write that down. But you can throw it back to them and say, go on, what do you want me to put? What should I put on here as a bullet point? Just sort of somebody give me, you know, a bullet point so we kind of know what that means. Yeah. And you throw it back to them. And then straight away, you'll have them all, you know, coming at you. Then you can have quite a laugh with it as well, actually, because you can then, there might be some clown in the class that will just, you know, come out with something. That'd hilarious, you know. Somebody might just say, you know, I always feel, I don't know, sexually frustrated or something, you know. And
because have I been in one of your courses?
You know, because they're trying to be the clown, they're trying to kind of like show you up, you know, because they kind of, and the trick then is that you don't bat an eyelid, just keep writing, just write it down as if it's the most normal thing in the world. And then as soon as they realize that, oh, well, she's just actually written that down, think, well, you've just told me that, I'm not gonna, it's not for me to.
Then how much of a douche how much of a douche do they feel when they've just got sexually frustrated on the wall, James said. Like, I will also note, whilst I said that was me, I don't do it because I want to belittle you as a trainer. I do it normally as it's my go-to thing when I'm nervous. So that's normally why I make a joke. But no, you're right. You get those people. But what I love about what you're saying is it. I've trained him for so long. Like I say, I've been like an accredited trainer for two separate companies, for the CAA actually, in kind of your space. I was accredited trainer by them for aviation security. Which was cool. We used to get like play with C4 and stuff.
Really, you'd go and like handle guns and stuff, don't you?
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, honestly, if you ever get opportunity, especially if you're like a proper typical boy and you love, like, you know, blowing stuff up, or, you know, girls like that stuff as well, but I mean stereotypically you're a boy and you like that stuff, and it's a great day to get that training. Like, you just go to like this police quarry thing where they blow shit up and they're shooting stuff, and it's just like,
cool. I might investigate this further, this sounds awesome.
So cool. So we were as a warehouse, we distributed so much abroad over air that it didn't make sense. It wasn't cost effective for us to have every pallet scanned. So we became approved kind of aviation secure unit, basically. So we
and had with dangerous goods training as well. Did you do that as well?
And we had like, you know, really strict like sign in and sign out. We had like high security areas with gates and stuff like that, and only approved people could go in there, and so on and so forth. But to have that, we had to have like initial aviation security induction training and then aviation security handling training as well. So me and this other lady had to become like approved trainers, which is basically when people go, what's that? And I was like, well, basically it's terrorism awareness. It's basically telling people how terrorists will target your products and sneak them onto a plane. So I need to train people to do that stuff. And now I think back on, before even talking to you, I would have done that training so different. But now talking to you, like, just, I can see, like, the things you're talking about, I can see I've done it and I was trained to do, like, be like that. Like, somebody saying, you know, me going to a room, your examples of fatigue, and then having a slide that says what I think. I've done that. 100% I've done that. And I'm not afraid to admit that because, you know, I think I have to admit that to become better. But it's like, I've definitely done that. And the little things you say that I would have probably actually never thought of, but once you say it makes so much sense in that, like, if somebody says an example that maybe is not quite right or maybe not quite where you're going, I would sometimes be a bit, I would definitely be like, okay, explain that for me. What are you thinking? Like, what made you come to that position? But the way that you talk about it, what you're trying to do, if I've interpreted it right, is make sure that you're not seen as the font of all information. You're seen as the kind of facilitator of their information.
It's all about making their experiences part of the learning process. Yeah. Because if you're using, I mean, there's a few little kind of like tricks of the trade that you can use. You know, the trick is to make it look very fluid, very flexible. But, you know, when you ask an open question, you know, I've done a training called the psychology behind, you know, stabilized and unstable approaches. So, you know, when you get basically screwed over by ATC and you end up high and fast, and then your approach can end up starting to get on what we call unstable, because, you know, you're not at the right height, the right speed, the right configuration at the right time, and therefore, you know, it can have consequences. So we look very carefully at those sort of ideas, and, you know, you sort of say to yourself, okay, well, give me some examples of, you know, how an approach, you know, might come unstable. Another example is that we were doing a training course recently on effective communication, which just sounds dull, I know, but actually the point of the training course, believe it or not, was to highlight that sometimes we don't have that communication. You know, we talk about that communication loop, you know, when you've got the feedback and the active listening and all those lovely things that we tick off and say, yes, that's very important. But sometimes the point of the training was to highlight that you don't always have that. And if you send an email, you don't have any of that communication loop. You don't even know that they've received it, frankly, let alone understood it. So, and the idea was to focus on the fact that you've got to be aware, guys, that whilst we go bang on about our effective communication and we all know how to do it, sometimes we just don't have that as an option to us. And so therefore we need to look at a different way of delivering that information because we don't have that full communication loop. So anyway, as a result of that, you know, we had this communication loop and we asked the class to give us different methods that they communicate with different people at work, you know, so whether they're communicating with engineering operations, whether they're communicating with each other, whether they're communicating with the ground crew, you know, what methods of communication do they use? And of course, the list is coming down the side because it's all done by Teams. It's all in the chat function. All the list is coming up. Now, the idea is then to work through a couple of examples to then show that, you know, the system doesn't work, but, you know, you can't do them all. And you know full well that email is going to come up. You know full well that the tech log is going to come up. You know full well that phone calls are going to come up. So what you do is you make sure that, you know, you're fully conversant with those three examples. And then you let them have their... So I'm telling all my secrets now.
Yeah, and I'm listening, that's for sure.
So you do their facilitation, you know, you get all their ideas, and this can work in any environment. You take their list, and then, you know, as soon as somebody says tech log, you think, oh yeah, tech log, right, brilliant, whatever. Secretly, what you're thinking is, thank God someone says tech log, because I need to do that one later.
So,
you know, for your example, if whatever industry you're in, you know, if you want to discuss a particular item further, you ask people their ideas, their thoughts, their experiences. And then you have to ask, by asking the question in a certain way, and then by, like you say, expanding on that, just expand that a little bit further for me, you know, give me an example of what you mean by that, and then they'll expand it a little bit further and you can pick a few things out of that. And then what you do, as soon as somebody's got what you want, you can then relax. you think, right, someone's got it. Brilliant. Let it carry on a little bit further. And then the next part of the lesson is you sort of sit back and you think, okay, let's take some of these examples and let's have a think about this then. So let's have a look at, tech log. Let's take the tech log as an example. And you make it look like you've just like randomly picked one off the list. But in actual fact, you're thinking, right, thank God.
In actual fact, you blue petered the shit out of this and you're ready to go with his one I prepared earlier.
Yeah, basically. But you make it look
totally
completely natural, completely off the cuff, you know. And I think that there's a little bit of the trick there. But if we go sort of back a little bit to answer the question you said before, you know, about the people that you have in the room. That's one of the most enjoyable things about being a facilitative style of trainer, but it's also one of the most daunting things as well, because you don't know who you're going to have. Now, I mentioned before with some of the training that we do, we have our pilot trainings, we have pilot initials, and we do upgrade training as well. So when people become a captain from being a first officer, there's some CRM training courses for that. Same with cabin crew, when they're junior to senior cabin crew, there's a course for that as well. But the recurrent training we often do is a combined session, so you have the pilots and the cabin crew in the same room together, and we're covering, it could be a case study, you know, some of the syllabus, whatever. But then of course you suddenly think, well, hang on a sec, I can't go and do all this like piloty stuff because the cabin crew are just going to not be interested and they're going to get lost. And it's a really fine balance actually between, you know, making it relevant to both sides of the operation, between making it relevant to the cabin crew, their experiences, their working environment, and then also keeping the pilots entertained, because the pilots love talking about flying. I mean, they love doing their piloty stuff, frankly. So you need to kind of keep them entertained. And so I would argue that, you know, out of all the courses we do, the combined session is probably the most difficult as a trainer, because, you know, you have to write courses that, you know, you can do with 25 people or you can do with 5 people. You know, you can't guarantee that you're always going to have that magic 16 people in a room, for example. You might only have 5 people one day, they might all be cabin crew. You might have 3 people one day, they might all be pilots. You might have 26 people one day, they could be a half split of pilots and cabin crew. And then, you know, with my previous operator, we had different fleets as well. So I had jet pilots and Dash 8 pilots. I had cabin crew that were type rated on both, on the basis that had both fleets. Some cabin crew were only Dash 8, some people were only jet, you know. So you've got all this mix. You can't just sort of like go off and like, okay, let's have a look at a case study about an e-jet, you know, because then the Dash people are thinking, oh god, my jets, you know, whatever. Equally, you focus it on the Dash and bloody Dash like this. And so, you know, you've got to really balance it, and being able to get that engagement and being able to get people in that class to not only feel valued, validated, making it relevant to them as individuals, not just as their job role, but to them as a person, whilst actually delivering some effective training, I would say is probably one of the hardest gigs that there is. And like I said, it requires quite a broad knowledge of the working environment and the subject in order to adapt whatever it is you're doing. Every single lesson you do, you have to adapt it to the room.
Yeah.
Which I love. I think it's great fun, but other people can find it a bit daunting. So we do a lot of training on that as well. We focus quite a lot on, okay, so how could you write this? How could you write that?
I feel like you need, like listening, like my brain's going mad listening to you, but like the three things that I feel, no, it's amazing. I'm desperate to, I've actually planned myself in my day job to deliver some workshops as soon as COVID will allow, face to face for this new scheme we're doing. And like, I'm just so excited to do them now, because I'm just like, I'm totally using all of this. Like, I love it. But like, I feel like there's kind of three things that you kind of need. Is like, you need a good knowledge of the subject that you're trying to get across. 100%. I think that's a given. You need a good broad knowledge of that and the audience that you're trying to communicate to. Like, so you need the kind of knowledge of the subject and what you're trying to achieve. And then I also think you kind of need confidence in yourself. Like, to do it, because it's quite a daunting thing to do, is stand up and be be a trainer and try and facilitate some conversation. Like you say, you always get the kind of classroom dickhead, and you always get the classroom grumpy person as well. In my experience, you know, it's really heavily dependent on the culture of the company. Like, some people see training, it might be different in what you do, but in my kind of health and safety training, a lot of the time people see that training as a way to bash the company. And they just sit all day. So it really depends on the culture of the company. So confidence in yourself to be able to deal with that that dynamic situation. But then also, to your earlier points, preparation. Like, I feel like they're the three key things, like knowledge, preparation, confidence in yourself. Yeah. And then I feel like you're getting close to becoming a pretty good facilitator or a good trainer.
Yeah, I that's a pretty good summary, actually. I mean, like I said, the key, in my opinion, the key to getting engagement with a class is validating them as people. This isn't my class. You know, I'm not in control of this. I'm here to, you know, have a discussion about things, maybe teach you a couple of things that we hadn't really thought about before. But and you know, okay, yeah, we'll always have the grumpy people in the class. You'll have the people that are just sat there like this and thinking, oh god, you know, can I go home yet, sort of thing. And you can spot them a mile off. You can tell by their body language that they're just not wanting to be there, and they're only there because they have to be, and they think they know it all, etc.
How would you deal with, sorry to interrupt, I'm just curious, how would you deal with that? Because that's something I've struggled with, is dealing with something like that. And I'd be curious, I'll give you an example. I've literally had a guy do this. I'll just take my headphones off for 1 second. Turn my cap around, right? I've literally had a guy do this. Cap down, pulls his cap down, slouches down in his chair, folds his arms, went to sleep. Honestly. Now, that makes me sound like a terrible trainer. Look at my hair, it's gone all mad. That makes me sound like a terrible trainer, because my training was that bad that he went to sleep. But this guy was going to sleep before we even started. Like, literally, I could tell the second he walked in that he was not engaged. He was not into this session whatsoever. And when, ironically, which I this was the fire training that I was talking about earlier, that I never let the guy live it down, because I knew this guy wasn't engaged. Like, the second he walked in, I could call it. Like you say, it's so obvious. The body language, they didn't want to be there. If they turned up a little bit late, the first thing they asked is, when's this going to finish? Like, and I think with safety training, there's always a perception that we have to deal with, and that they think it's going to be death by PowerPoint. You know, they've always made the decision of this training is going to be shit before they're even there. And, you know, I've been told that so many times. So actually, I was surprised that this training was actually quite good. But I just knew this guy turned up, he didn't want to be there. He'd pre-decided what this was going to be. And like, come in, he's like, well, time's just going to finish. And he fell asleep during one of the stories of the fireman telling his story. And when we had dinner later, I said, I told you your stories were boring, mate. You made him fall asleep. But like, you know, he was just he just didn't want to be there. And I'm not going to use that as a reflection on me and him. Because I think it's the second, as much as I would do that training differently now, but the second he got there, I knew he wasn't engaged. So I'd be curious to just see, maybe if you've come across it, but like, how would you deal with a situation like that?
Well, there's two approaches I take, actually. The situation that you've just explained, where you've got somebody who is just overtly, you know, dismissing what's going on and doesn't want to be there, I play to their ego. So I engage them. Overtly engage them, you know, because, you know, within the aviation context, and of course within my previous operator, then, you know, you kind of got a guess, you know what rank they are, you got a list of, you know, where they're based, and, you know, what position, whether on the dash 8, whether they're on the jet, whether they're a captain, training captain, you know, whatever it is, so you know what rank they are. So the first you know, plan of attack, if you like, is to play to their ego. So, you know, as soon as you start opening up a facilitative discussion, you can say, you know, I don't know, Bob, like, let's just call him Bob.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And say, well, this is really interesting, you know, and, you know, somebody like Bob here, who, you know, is a senior captain on the jet, you know, he's going to have seen a lot more stuff than you have. That's fair, isn't it, Bob? You know, you must have seen this a lot. You know, you must have some great stories that you can share with us here.
You're like an evil genius, Helen. I love that.
Well, particularly you talk about like winter operations or something, you know, and they said, come on, you've been in the company for, you know, 8 years. You must have some story. You must have some stuff that you've seen that, you know, would just make everybody's eyes wide. And straight away, you're not picking on them in saying, right, come on, you, what's the answer? And humiliating them and making them feel rubbish. But you're actually engaging them and saying, and as if to say, you know, I said, you know, I'm so pleased that you are here, Bob, because, you know, you must have seen this stuff before. You must have so many stories that you can tell us of stuff that you've seen. So that usually gets them on side because they think, oh, I'm important. She likes what I can do, you know, but and so that's that one fixed. The other approach is almost the complete opposite. You know, I've had people who have been, you know, sat at the back of a class. I tend not to have fronts and backs of classes. I can't remember if we talked about this last time about room layouts and how room layouts can really affect, you know, how the group behaves. But, you know, if you've got somebody who's just, you know, clearly sat there like this, you know, texting on their phone or, you know, not engaging or whatever, I just go and stand just a little bit too close to them. Mm-hmm. Just invade their personal space really passive aggressively. You know, I don't say anything along the lines of, can you put your phone down, please? Because that's really rude, because you're just humiliating them. And then you're kind of like controlling that. And everyone's going to just think you're a twat, frankly. But you can be very, very devious. And, you know, because you've got the ability to move around the room. So if I see somebody is clearly just being, you know, rude, frankly, you know, and I put that down to rude, is that I position myself in the classroom. I just naturally walk around the classroom and just stand that little bit too close that makes them feel uncomfortable so that they kind of aware that I know exactly what's going on. I'm not very happy about it. But to anybody else in the room, I'm just stood there. You know, I don't make it look as if I'm sort of staring down my nose at or anything like this. You know what it's like when you've just got somebody who's just standing that little bit too close to you for comfort. I kind of do that quite a lot as well.
I love that. And again, that comes back to the preparation thing as well, doesn't it? Because of the way you've designed the room, it enabled you to do that. So I think back to that same example. We had designed the room with a front and back, because actually the way that you describe how we designed a room in the last time we spoke, that really was eye-opening for me. It really was eye-opening for me. I've been on trainer courses, you know, no one's ever spoke about how we design a room. Never.
I've never really been taught it either, if I'm honest with you. I guess it's just one of those things that I've learned by experience, I suppose, by trial and error. I think I gave the example last time of the time I was suddenly had a group of like 36 people and I was chucked into this room that was, you know, the size of a football field. It was massive. And I thought, oh my God, this isn't going to work. But as a result of that, you know, I noticed over the course of my time doing the training that, you know, certain room layouts suit certain training objectives and certain demographics as well. So if I've got a very small group of pilots, I would have the room set out in a very, very different way to a group of 20 mixed of flight deck and cabin crew. So as a result of that, you know, talking about train the trainer, we do a whole module now. We do a whole hour on room layouts, simply room layouts. Amazing. And we actually lay the room out in different ways and say, you know, how comfortable is this? But we look at it. It's not about you as the instructor. You look at it from the perspective of the delegate. Yeah. So how does sitting like this make you feel? And, you know, one of the room layouts I absolutely despise, and I don't know why anybody does it, and apologies to anybody who thinks this is a great idea, because it really isn't, is when you have what I call it the open you. He's gonna So you basically just have like a semicircle of chairs in the middle of the room. And people just like sit there. And
yeah, I've never done that.
In your normal life, when would you ever put a chair in the middle of the room and just sit on it? You don't do that. You know, it's not comfortable for those people. They feel, I'm going to use the word exposed. You do feel exposed. You feel vulnerable because you haven't got anything to hide behind.
Oh, it makes me so embarrassed when you, I think you did this, you called me out on this in the last episode.
Did I say that? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to rub it in and say it again.
If anyone's not watching this on YouTube, they would not be able to see the pure like redness in my face. Like, it's so obvious to me now, but like, nah, that was probably my preferred layout. I mean, I'm authentic, I will say, yeah. And now I'm like, shit. Because like when you explained it last time, like that person's got nothing in front of them other than this void where James walks up and down in this domineering fashion. And they're so vulnerable. And I'm just like, holy shit. I never realized the subconscious impact that was. I never put the chair in the middle. I hate, like, I wouldn't put the chair in the middle and sit in that.
It's a bit Darren Brown, isn't it?
But I did like to be able to walk up and down the room and well, just, yeah, the fuck, I've got no words. Like,
I mean, some people are going to probably watch this and say, oh yeah, but you know, what about if you haven't got a lot of space? And, you know, so what I then call, you know, theatre style, where you've got rows and rows of chairs, but without desks. So rows and rows with desks is what I call classroom style. Yeah. And then rows and rows without desks is theatre style.
Yeah.
As long as you have a row of desks in the front, then you can get away with that. Because the row behind, just a chair, that's okay, because you've got somebody or something in front of you. So, but the very front row, you either need to just block it off and say, look, no one's going to sit here. And then you'll have people in the front row. It won't be the front row, it'll be the second row, but it's actually in the front row because you've blocked off the front row. Or if you've got just a row of desks, you can put a row of desks at the front, and then you can then have the rows of chairs behind. Otherwise, and like I said, you just need to sort of like imagine yourself being sat in a social environment, you know, in a bar, in a cafe, in a at your house, and think, well, you know, what, how do I sit in the house? And nobody ever puts a row of chairs in a house and just sits there.
Why
do it in a classroom? Because it's so uncomfortable. Not uncomfortable physically on the chair, but emotionally uncomfortable. And you feel exposed and vulnerable sat like that. It's horrible.
It's so true.
In a training environment where you're wanting people to engage and wanting to be included in what you're talking about, why on earth do we then make them feel psychologically uncomfortable from the start? And then the other things that we talk about as well is have it not just with the seating, not just the seating layouts, like where do you put the tables and the chairs, etc., but it's also where do people actually sit? And you know, I've met trainers even now. I've had to have a word sometimes. It's quite senior trainers who people come in and they sit down and straight away they're saying, right, come on, let's mix you all up, please. You know, we can't have all the pilots together. You know, it's really good to mix everybody up so you get to meet somebody new. Like, seriously, it's really not, you know. If I'm going to come on a training course, I want to sit by my friends or somebody that I know or in a particular place where I feel comfortable. It's very, very rare that you actually need to have certain ranks or roles sat in certain places. Mm. And you can address that right from the start. You know, you can just say, look guys, free reign of where you sit, but can I ask, please, that we have at least, you know, one or two flight crew members on this side and two of you on that side. But you've got to give them control of where they sit. Mm. Because again, that can make you feel really uncomfortable, you know? It's the whole wedding anxiety. You know, when you go to a wedding and like you're all separated up and sitting next to other people.
That's so true. Never thought of it like that. But that's
all my anxieties.
That's such a good example. That's such a good example. And I've never thought of it like that, but that's so true. Like, like when you're having to sit like, yeah, with people that you don't ever really know. And I think you know, if you've got any wits about you, you probably try and sit people next to it. But we planned the wedding and you know, we planned our wedding, and that was we were very much aware of that. We chose not to have a head table. We just had loads of round tables in quite a thin room, but we had loads of round tables. We've worked really hard to put people on tables with who they knew. And actually, me and Sherry, we didn't sit together. Sherry sat on one table and I sat on another table.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, we didn't sit together. And it's really funny. You see in our wedding video, like we walk into this dinner room and then I just go, see you later. And then, yeah, we just got married. I'm like, see ya. And she goes to sit on one table and I sit on the other. And that was partly because we wanted our friends to enjoy ourselves. We wanted our friends to relax and we wanted to be with our friends just as much as we wanted to be with our family and with each other. And we were going to spend the rest of our lives together. So why don't we, you know, we might as well just have the next couple of hours apart. But also because there were a couple of people that we were like, actually, they only know Sherry or they only know me, but we really want them to come. So it actually makes sense to put them on that table, but I'll sit at that table and Sherry, you can go sit at that table and they can sit with you to make them feel comfortable. But I would have never attached that to training. But when you use that example, it's so true. And sometimes, you know, you get, we've had it, and I know our friends, I'm cautious of saying this because I know my friend does listen to my podcast. And I'm going to, if he can remember his wedding, he'll probably think he's talking about my wedding. But, you know, I've been a best man and had to sit at the head table, leaving my wife kind of a table without me. And then the person she was with, his wife was the maid of honor. So she was at the head table as well. So it was, and they knew each other anyway, but still a quite awkward situation. And I felt sorry for them having to try and plan that. But we would, that was in our head. We were going through and we were just like, well, let's just get rid of the head table. We don't like the idea of a head table anyway. But yeah. Anyway, we spent way too long talking about my wedding, but when I start to compare that to training, it's so true. There are lessons to be learned there.
And it is. It's so much about, you know, if you want the class to engage and you want them to participate and feel comfortable, then you've got to allow them to feel comfortable. Yeah. And if that means letting them sit where they want to sit, because some people will be happier nearer the front. Some people will be happy if they can sort of sit sideways using their left hand, their right hand. Somebody will want to sit next to their mate because they haven't seen them for a long time. Fine. Do you know what? You sit where makes you feel comfortable. Because, you know, I kind of need you on side, really.
Yeah, so because what are we trying to achieve here is their engagement. And for their engagement, we need them to be comfortable. And yeah, it just makes sense now. Everything you're saying makes sense. But that is not how I think safety people are trained to train. I think if you're trained to train, that's not how. Because all of those tactics that you talk about, which now just make so much sense that they are stupid, like let's mix people up, let's get you uncomfortable. And it's like, hang on a minute, what we've said there is just exactly what we don't want. We want them to be.
The first thing I've done is just pissed you off, frankly. Yeah.
Is there a time? Is there a time where you might want them to be uncomfortable and you might want to mix them up or not?
First, the former, no, the latter, yes. We did a combined session about 2 or 3 years ago, I think it was. And we were looking at a case study and I wanted them in groups as close as possible to be what I call constituted crews. So a mix of flight deck and cabin crew. So the only stipulations is as they walked in, I put a little note on the whiteboard and say, please can we make sure we have at least one pilot and at least one cabin crew member on each table.
Yeah.
And there was like three tables of, you know, 6 or 8 seats, however one it was. So that was my only stipulation. So as long as there was at least one pilot and one cabin crew member on each table, then the rest of the table didn't really matter, because then it tended to naturally sort itself out, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. If I only had 2 pilots on the course and I had 3 tables, then obviously we couldn't achieve that. But, you know, we do what we can. So we have, you know, pilot on each table. But then they didn't have to sit there kind of feeling awkward, because all the exercises that we had, all the discussion items. So it was basically looking through a case study and I read it kind of like a bit like a story. I think we talked about this last time, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
When I actually read the story.
Yeah, this blew my mind. This blew
it was
mind.
Quite amusing.
So you took your daughter, like did you steal a book off your daughter or something, if I remember right?
Yeah, nursery rhyme, nursery story, my first nursery stories. And I had my notes in the book. Yeah. And then every time a word was written in blue with a star, I had to press my clicker, because then it brought up the relevant picture behind my head, which related to the story at the time. So it looked very natural, but it was actually so very, very prescriptive. But then every now and again, we would then stop the story and say, well, hang on a sec. in your tables, if, let's imagine that you are this crew, okay? You're the cabin crew, you're the pilots, you know, what would you do? What would you actually do given this particular scenario? So we kind of got them to discuss the scenario and, you know, what they might do in that particular situation, but as a constituted crew. So therefore that's why I needed, you know, to have pilots and cabin crew on each table so that they could then act as if they were a crew, which made it more kind of realistic to what they would be like, you know, around. But it's not really an uncomfortable situation for them, because every morning, every afternoon before they flight, you know, we have tables in our crew. We had, like, so last year, we had tables
in literally rooms
when everybody would sit around, you know, a table having a briefing. So it felt like it was just a pre-flight briefing, you know, discussing a scenario. So it wasn't an abnormal scenario. But no, I'm failing to think of an example where I would want people to feel uncomfortable and awkward. Unless that was the learning objective, you know, when we're looking perhaps at personalities, behaviours and, you know, self-awareness, perhaps, you know, to give that experiential learning, to make people feel awkward, because when you behave like that, that's how they feel. Maybe, I don't know, but I haven't done it yet. I don't see any benefit in it at all, frankly. My objective is to make the room as comfortable. There's a lot of talk at the moment about psychological safety within organisations.
Which is what we're talking about really here, isn't it?
Well, I think that's probably thinking about it. That's probably what I try and achieve in my class.
Definitely.
Is this psychological safety where anybody can question anything, anybody can say anything, discuss anything, nothing is dismissed, nobody is belittled, nobody is humiliated, everybody feels comfortable, physically comfortable, but also psychologically comfortable as well, because everything that they do is endorsed and, you know, and validated, I suppose. So well, they might even learn something as well, you know.
Yeah, or not just become just really comfortable for like a few hours. They didn't learn shit, but they were really comfortable.
But, you know, we had a good laugh. Yeah. but interesting enough, what you've just said is like the other side of it, actually. So traditionally, CRM training has all been, I put it under the banner, well, that's all very interesting, but what's the point? Yeah. You know, and I still see it now, you know, that have a discussion about something, which is, yeah, it's quite interesting, but
what's the point?
Why are we discussing this? Yeah. And so one of the other things is that we teach on the Train the Trainer course is actually how to develop lesson plans. I said before that, you know, we have these cycles of topics. So in one training cycle, you might have 7 or 8 topics that you have to cover, because there's, I don't know, about 20 things that you have to do over the 3-year period. And the reality of it is that you might only get an hour and a half to do 7 topics. So if you start siloing it, we still see that a lot, actually, that people say, right, we're going to talk about information processing. Oh, now we're going to talk about decision making. That's not realistic. So one of the things we talk about is developing lesson plans and actually starting from the end game and actually identifying
what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah, but from a training needs analysis. So, you know, we train them to go to the, you know, the actual training managers, the heads of training, the safety department, and say, look, this year we're developing the combined CRM. Don't talk about the syllabus for now, because the syllabus can always be fitted into the materials, I found. So what is it that we need to cover? What are the trends? You know, what are the safety concerns? What are the training deficiencies that we're seeing as a broad generalization? And so what we do is we identify what it is we're going to cover. Then we look at, okay, how are we going to cover this? How can we make this effective by bringing in some of the CRM theories and principles? And then at the end of it, we then sort of go through and say, well, actually, yeah, we've covered all that. And it could be that we're missing one particular part, in which case, okay, so we need to talk in a little bit about, I don't know, effective communication between ground services. Okay, well, let's bring that into this section here. And then so we kind of teach people to work backwards. So we start with what is the point, and then we kind of write the training session, because what you'll find is you can deliver a 45-minute session on a particular learning topic, and you might have covered sort of like, I don't know, 6 or 7 topics within the syllabus, maybe not even the ones you need to cover, but the point is they're kind of embedded within there, because as you know, within safety, looking at human factors, then you don't silo it, you know, everything overlaps, everything affects everything else. So actually it's worth highlighting that within the training as well, and actually saying, look, we're not going to silo it, we're going to talk today about the psychology of stable and unstable approaches, because that's come up as an identified training need as a result of a particular spate of particular reports that have come from a particular airfield. So let's have a talk about that, you know, let's have a talk about what's going on here and give you some another tool and other skills to recognize it, understand that it's not your fault, you know, but let's focus on fixing it. And so you kind of develop it that way as well. So it's not only about teaching it, but it's also about sort of the background research as well. And we do that all in 5 days.
That's just phenomenal. Like, I think there's so much that we as a profession for more general safety training or even any training can take away from that. Like 100%, like all of those things we said, but even if it was just that last thing that we're talking about, like, I think so many times if we actually ask ourselves, like really critically ask ourselves, what are we trying to achieve from this training? And do we think we'll deliver it from this training session I've designed? And I think a great example would be manual handling training. I don't know if you've ever been on a manual handling training course, right? But it's always in a room, lifting boxes off the floor, onto the table, off the table, back onto the floor. And sometimes we might mix it up by putting something that moves in there. So that, you know, when you pick it up, you're like, oh, the center of gravity moves. Like, ooh. Like, yeah, that would really entertain my 6-month-old for about 30 seconds and then she'd be bored of it because it's stupid and it's shit. But if you actually ask, what are we trying to achieve here? We're trying to achieve people lifting better. Get out of that boardroom, go on a shop floor, and then just facilitate some real life learning on the spot. On the spot, right? Who works in this area? Are you working in this area? Cool. Let's just run us through what work looks like, please. And let's do that. Like, what kind of manual handling do you do here? What do we think about? And if you want to do some of the technical, to your point, like knowledge transfers of how the back works and stuff like that, then we can do that in the classroom if we need to. What we could also facilitate it in the moment as well on the workplace. So, and I just think if we critically ask ourselves, what are we trying to achieve from this session? I think 9 times out of 10, we'd end up getting our butt off the chairs and just going into the workplace and actually looking at stuff. But we have this preconception of what training should look like. I think the training should be a knowledge transfer from PowerPoint to person, and it's just like, oh god. So there's definitely so much we can take away from that you said, and that's just one thing that, you know, I kind of picked up off that last bit. It's just mind-blowing. Definitely.
Well, I mean, like I said, you know, there's a lot of the stuff that, you know, we look at from the you know, how to train parts of it. Let's not look at the specifics of how to train the aviation related topics, but looking at the differences of instruction versus facilitative training, you know, who benefits from what, why do we do it, why is this important, why is that important? Because the important thing to recognize is that both of those techniques and those styles have a place. They both have, you know, their little niche. You know, it's not that you must always, it's like leadership styles. There is no one leadership style that suits every single environment. You have to make that assessment based on, you know, the scenario that you're faced with. And it's the same with teaching styles. You know, you have to have this enormous wealth, you know, people call it, oh, your toolbox, another cliches, you know, of different ways to achieve the same goal. You know, like you say, it's about applying the right skill and the right technique, and you know that some of the best trainers that I've observed, you know, as an examiner, but also, you know, when I've been on a course myself and I'm watching them closely, is that they just flip between instructor facilitator facilitator, and it's seamless. It's absolutely seamless, and you just think, oh, I aspire to that, you know, that's kind of what I aspire to, is to be able to just do that. So this is kind of, again, it's one of the areas that we cover, because there is a place for instructional delivery. Yeah. There absolutely is. There must be, particularly at initials, you know, when we're actually looking at the company culture and, you know, competency frameworks and actually the applied CRM side of things, the assessment kind of things, there is a place for instructional knowledge transfer. But certainly in recurrent, and certainly when we're doing the combined sessions, you know, you've just got to adapt. You've got to adapt to the class. You've got to really know your stuff. I mean, really, really know your subjects and know the objectives. You know, why are we teaching this? To then, you know, get the best out of that class and hope, you know, so they can go away thinking. And there's nothing I love more. I mean, the best endorsement I could ever have was when somebody would walk out of that class and say, I really enjoyed that, Helen. Yeah. Thank you. Really, awesome. Really enjoyed it. I thought, right, that's it. My life is complete.
Yeah. It's awesome. I've worked for a company once that culture wasn't very good. And it was very much like really command and control culture and stuff like that. And to your point there, like one of the best feedbacks I've ever got off a training session was she came over to me and she went, I'm surprised you haven't been fired yet. And I was like, oh, sorry, what? And she went, because that training was the best training I've been on, but that does not fit within this company. And I was like, thanks, I think. But like what she was trying to say was like, she's been desperate for a different approach to the culture of this business. And when she had the training and it was a bit more, I'm not bigging myself up, but you know, it was just a good example. And that's always stuck in my head. And you're right. That keeps me bouncing for years. Even when I think back on it now, I just think, oh, what a great compliment that was. Also a real good insight into what the culture was like of that company. But anyway.
Yeah.
Right, we have been speaking for a long time, Helen.
Oh, it's been so much fun talking to you. I kind of want to do some train the trainer. I want to kind of do some training courses with you now. I'm just like, oh, I'm all fired up.
I feel like I want you to train me all over again how to be a trainer, if I'm honest. So we'll wrap it up. So like, how is there anyone? Is there anyone you kind of? So you mentioned this trainer course you're doing with I can't remember how to pronounce the company. Do you want to just
Kura? K-U-R-A. Yeah.
Right. Do you want to just tell us about the work you're doing there and if people are in that space and they needed to get involved or wanted to get involved, how they could do that?
Yeah, of course. How can I start this? My role primarily now then is as a training course director with Kura Human Factors. So they look actually at developing human factors training across multiple industries, actually, not just aviation. The course I'm specifically involved with, as I said before, is the CRM trainers course, which we've got courses running I think every other month from May onwards. I want to say it's a week-long okay. course, but we also do refresher training. So one of the EASA regulatory requirements for all CRM trainers is to do refresher training once every 3 years, so we also offer that as an integrated course as well. But you know, if anybody's looking to do you know, refresher of just trainer skills, we can do sort of like one-off courses for that as well, and sort of the fundamental of, you know, training delivery in the style that we do. You know, if there's anything that you want to know, then give Kura a call and you know, we can find the right person for the right job.
Awesome, that's great. Thank you very much, Helen. Thank you very much for your time. You're blowing my mind as per usual. I think we'll definitely have to get you back on. You're amazing.
Oh, thank you so much. Honestly, I was so flattered, and
I just feel sorry for all the people I've done training to literally done training to, compared to how you do training. Like, I feel like I've just spoken to people over the years. I just feel sorry for all of those people because my training will be so much different now, and hopefully so much better. So thank you very much for that. Okay, peeps, hope you enjoyed that conversation with Helen. She's such a lovely lady, and I thank her very much for coming back on the podcast. I love the chat. Don't forget to check in a couple of days where I'll be going through some of my notes and reflecting on this conversation with Helen. So that'll be out in the next few days. Next Monday will be just an episode from me where I'm going to pick out something that may be happening on LinkedIn lately that's been very popular and just have an initial thought about it. I'm doing a lot of work in the behind the scenes to do a bit more around that. So there'll just be a little chat coming next Monday, and then the following Monday we've got the kickoff episode of our new quarterly co-host, which is Rob Fisher. If those of you that know Rob Fisher, he does the essential leadership cycle work. He's a human organizational performance guy based over in America, but he does things slightly differently, which is really interesting. And this quarterly co-host three episodes is really fascinating because it's going to be essentially a step-by-step journey through his model. You know, you're going to get real insight into working with him and how he kind of manages stuff. It really is a kind of how-to manual of that next evolution in kind of a better culture, a safer business, a more effective business. So make sure you check that out. Not next Monday. Next Monday's just me waffling on. The following Monday will be me and Rob Fisher just going in depth into step one with his
style of implementation, I suppose, and how to evolve into the next level. Don't forget to check out Paradigm Human Performance. Their learning organization webinar is phenomenal, so go check that out. But if you're a small and medium-sized enterprise and you feel like you need a bit more support on safety, then please check out Paradigm Human Performance's HSC subscription service. I have every bit of faith in Paradigm, and I love what they're doing. I wouldn't be telling you about them. I wouldn't be partnering with them if I didn't agree with what they do. Go check them out, please. They are so good, and they will help you out. And even if you don't work with them, just check out that webinar, because it is a gold mine of information. And finally, if you're a safety professional, you're a operational professional that manages safety or risk, or you're even a risk professional, then Project Miletium is the mastermind community for you. We are focused on having valuable conversations within our community to help us all grow. We run that in our weekly community calls, a brand new philosophy call that we run every month, where we do some real in-depth conversations around things like, what is safe? What even is safe? Hosted by an expert, I suppose. He would hate that I call him that, but he's an expert compared to me. A hobbyist, maybe. Let's call him that. A hobbyist philosopher within safety. A guy that's doing so much work. His name is Simon Cassin. Runs a company called Ouch Training. He's a safety professional. He's got an amazing background. But has recently, over the last few years, within his education, took on kind of philosophy and realized that actually, we significantly lack philosophy within the safety profession. So we've been talking to him how we can help him get his message out there. And he's going to facilitate a monthly philosophy call for the Project Miletium members, exclusive. I am not aware of any philosophical conversations going on around safety other than at Project Miletium. So if there's one reason you should join, that's probably it. But actually, our community calls are phenomenal. Our wagon wheel yesterday just made my heart melt. It was just so raw and powerful and emotional. It was just amazing, amazing. And we've got a book club that we run every month as well. And then there's loads of resources for our community. And the conversation we have in our LinkedIn group, some of the most rich, in-depth conversations I've seen. We're collaborating on loads of stuff. We're helping each other build our management systems, our culture, our behaviors and work, absolutely everything. Absolutely everything. So go check out Project Miletium, or DM me, or DM Colin Nottage, the other co-founder, or email me and Colin at me@projectmiletium.com. All the details in the description below. But if you let us know, we can get you on a free of charge call to try it out first. Thanks for listening to this conversation with Helen. I'll catch you in a couple of days while I reflect, and I'll catch you next Monday when I'm talking about, well, anything really, but I think you know what I'm going to be talking about. Catch you later, peeps. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only, based on limited and dated open source information, and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.